Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. African swine fever is an incurable disease that's currently spreading between pig populations in Africa, Asia, and Europe. It affects domestic pigs and wild boar and has a mortality rate between 95 and 100%. There is no risk to human health, but the World Organization for Animal Health says the disease is the biggest threat to commercial pig production the industry has ever seen. In the UK, there have been no reported cases, and the government says there is a medium risk of it arriving here. So how are pig farmers and the wider pork industry preparing? What preventative measures can be taken, and how well will those industries cope should the disease be detected in the UK? Well, with me to discuss this are Nick Allen, Chief Executive of the British Meat Processing Association. Hello there, Nick.
Hello there.
Great to have you. Stuart Houston, Chair of Red Tractor Pigs. Hello, Stuart.
Hi.
And Rebecca Veal, Chief Policy Advisor at the National Pig Association. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello.
Well, it's great to have all of you on the podcast. Now, African swine fever is a global concern right now. But before we get into what's going on at the moment, I'd just like to understand a little bit more about the disease. Rebecca, where and when did it first appear?
So African swine fever, or sometimes as we term it ASF, because we love an acronym in agriculture, it emerged in the early 1900s, unsurprisingly in East Africa, and it spread out of that continent a couple of times. First back in the late 50s and 60s, came into Portugal, into Europe, the Caribbean and Brazil. But that from that incursion, it was eradicated from everywhere apart from Sardinia, where it still does sit. Secondly, it came into Georgia in the 2000s, a different genotype, so we can tell the difference, and then spread into Russia and Eastern Europe, where it stayed for some time. In 2018, it was reported in China, so we started to see it over in the East, and it has spread out of China into lots of Asian and Oceanic countries. And in the last few years, it's also it's spread into the Dominican Republic and Haiti. But the most challenge that we've faced has been where it spread from Eastern Europe into more of mainland Europe, into Germany, most recently Italy, and it's posing more of an issue as it's very much closer to our doorstep.
Rebecca, what are the symptoms and how easily does it spread? And I mean, is it always fatal for the pig? I mean, 90, 95 to 100% mortality just sounds horrific.
So ASF, or African swine fever, as I said, affects swine. So it is pigs and that can be kept, or feral pigs, but also in this country it might be wild boar that are affected. In other parts of the world it can be warthogs, bush pigs and forest hogs as well. So it only affects those species. Clinical signs, the pig becomes very unwell, so they have a fever, loss of appetite, lack of energy, and then most importantly, sudden death. There are other symptoms as well. They can be sick and have sore eyes, etc. But they're the key things that you would see. And it generally is fatal to pigs. And it is what is termed as a notifiable disease, which means there are legal requirements should it be found. And it is a legal requirement if you suspect there is African swine fever to report it to government, and then they take subsequent action.
Yeah. So how does it spread? I mean, is it sort of the wild boar and the travelling of unregulated, unplotted animal movements that really spread it, or are there other reasons as well?
So in Africa, it's a tick that's involved. Luckily, we don't have that tick in this part of the world. So there is an insect vector, as we term it, in other parts of the world. In Europe, we very much see a pig-to-pig transmission. It can be spread by any kind of fomite. So that might be excretions, such as urine or feces. It can be on remnants of those on equipment, vehicles, and then most importantly, it can also be spread in meat. And this is a virus that's really robust. So it can survive in frozen meat for up to 1,000 days, which is incredibly scary.
That is, it's terrifying. Now, Stuart, I saw that one of the places affected was the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Now, these are relatively remote islands, a long, long way away from Africa and not connected to a major landmass. So how does it, there must be other ways that it spreads as well. How could that happen?
Yeah, Rebecca's right. It moves very aggressively from pig to pig, but it also holds firm in pig meat products. And human beings, therefore, are the biggest vector for it shifting from country to country and making these huge leaps that we've seen in Europe. And this comes through people either inadvertently or deliberately bringing product that is infected, but they probably don't know is infected, from country to country in their baggage. And sometimes it's product that is a speciality for a country, so they think they're doing their friends and family a favour by bringing a delicacy, but actually they're delivering a time bomb.
And what's interesting about Haiti and Dominican Republic is that they are islands, and I think if everyone thinks that the UK is safe from these things because we're an island, that implies that that's not the case. Would that be true, Stuart?
Yeah, and there's been a recent significant uplift in the amount of attention that the port authorities have been paying to imports, and quite a substantial amount of illegal meat products, not just pig meat, but meat products have been picked up. And, you know, we are really keen that messages about this get out to the general public and that these interferences by the regulatory authorities happen more often.
Yeah. Okay, so Nick, the disease isn't here in the UK, thankfully, but it has arrived in Europe. What has been the impact on the pork industries in those affected countries?
Yeah, and I think before I talk about the European countries, I think it's worth just reflecting on China because, you know, I come back to later on, actually, the significance of China in terms of the impact of this is quite important to understand. When that initial outbreak happened in sort of China's Chinese pig industry, which is the largest in the world by a long, long way, was completely decimated. They lost massive numbers. It's always difficult to know the numbers. But the cost of that was estimated to be about $111 billion in terms of impact. So, you know, that influence on the sort of the whole world, the sort of economy, should not be underestimated. Now, unfortunately, yes, we've got it in Europe, and actually it's been spreading across really from the eastern sort of side of Europe, mainly sort of by wild boar, but then we did sort of see it make one of these jumps that Stuart talked about into Belgium, which we're pretty convinced was actually by human transmission, you know, but it's always difficult to prove these things. Mm. But it made a sudden leap across, and that was quite worrying when it sort of got that close. But the impact on these countries, it causes havoc internally because immediately the authorities start to regionalize or try and control the movements. So farmers are subject to sort of movements or controls. And then likewise, sort of abattoirs in some instances can be sort of have difficulty where they can sort of source pigs from, things like that. So it causes a lot of logistical internal disruption. And just as importantly, and I come back to, you know, sort of a country very often loses export markets. Yeah. Countries delist you if you've got it. And ironically, China, even though a lot of people feel it's rife in China, are very sensitive about this. So you sort of lose that export market. Sort of China, and that can have a sort of a real impact on the value of your pigs, really. I mean, we saw during the pandemic, we lost a couple of plants in this country that sort of got delisted from sort of China, and we'd estimate that sort of immediately takes about 18 to 20 pounds off the value of a pig if you sort of can't export to sort of China. So if you lose those export markets as a sort of pig industry, that could be sort of quite a problem as well, really. So
it's a strange paradox, isn't it? Because as Chinese pork production drops, you'd expect the value of everyone else's pork meat to go up. But then if they're going to ban German pork meat, for instance, that's I believe that's half a million tons of pig meat that stays in Europe. And what's the impact of that?
Well, it does. It disrupts our market completely, you know, and we've seen the sort of the European sort of prices sort of drop dramatically. Their prices are on the whole now recovering, but mainly because the industry's been through a really traumatic sort of period, and we've seen a decline in the pig production sort of both in this country quite dramatically and in Europe. So the sort of the prices are coming up now, but yeah, it has an immediate effect on the sort of the price of, you know, that the farmer gets for pigs, you know, so and that obviously impacts on whether they stay in business, really.
Yeah, so lots of farmers across Europe are having to, well, are losing large amounts of their herds. Now, what impact, let's posit a scenario where we did have an outbreak in the UK, a serious outbreak, how would it unfold and what are the potential economic consequences, Nick?
Well, I'd like to think, you know, because we haven't got the wild boar population, hopefully we might stand a sort of better chance of controlling it a bit here. But immediately, I, we would leap into actually regionalisation, depending on where it happened. So it depended where it first appeared. You know, it's because we haven't got that wild boar population. It's going to arrive here probably because someone, as Stuart alluded to, has brought some meat into the country and been careless with it. I think that's the likely scenario. And that's why we'll talk about sort of the imports or controls sort of later on, really. But yeah, immediately you'd start to see regionalization. And it depends where it first appeared, how difficult that would make, you know, make life sort of for people, really. And it depends on the whether the pig, that particular sort of pig unit is part of an integrated sort of set up, and maybe it was rearing its pigs in one part of the sort of country and then moving them to another part for finishing and things like that. So the movement restrictions immediately, but the most serious concern would be losing the export markets, you know, particularly to China, because that would have an immediately devastating effect on the sort of the pork price, which is just nicely starting to recover and giving sort of farmers some respite from the difficulties they've had for the last 2 years.
Yeah. And would there be widespread culling, Rebecca, if it was here in the UK?
No. So culling is based on risk. So firstly, the government need to contain that infected premises and that herd. And like Nick alluded to, it's hugely variable in terms of the response that they would take and how wide that would be, how big zones would be, because that's based on that very specific scenario. So we do loads of contingency planning and think about all these various options, and it will be something completely different, I'm quite sure. So they contain, they control, and they eradicate. So, culling takes place on uninfected herds only unless the CVO orders it on a broader scale. So sometimes that's done on a risk-based basis. But it's not a widespread cull unless you had widespread disease. I suppose a bit like we have seen this year with avian flu. There have been a number of infected premises. But what you end up there with is very large and protection and surveillance zones. And we're actually due to have some regulations brought in later this year, we believe, to actually give government the powers to make those restriction zones even bigger. Yeah. And they vary based on the type of disease. So if it's in wild boar, for instance, or if it's in a kept pig. So we can end up with very big zones with maybe one infected premises or a small number, but actually a very large number of herds affected by the requirements of that zone, which will be inability to move pigs, etc.
Yeah.
Move pigs quite a lot, so it has huge amount of disruption. We saw it last year in eastern Germany. It's a very pig-dense region. They've had a number of outbreaks. They had some very large zones, and producers really struggled. So they didn't grant any licences to move pigs, or very few. And so they ended up with quite a large backlog on farm. It has huge financial implications in terms of what farmers are able to sell their pigs for, and equally in terms of the pig flow, because as Nick's members, like, you know, they work very hard to keep pork on our shelves. And when you disrupt that pig flow, it can affect what's available on the shelf.
Nick, it's probably worth putting into context the last figures I saw. Nick's already mentioned that exports would end if we got even one pig and one outbreak. And export contribute about a third to the current pig price. So you can imagine what would happen if we can't export. Mm. And then there's another knock-on effect. The trade for sows that have ended their productive life is all across in Europe. About 90% of our geld sow carcasses end up in Europe, and that would stop too. So that's two really big effects for the pig production sector, as well as giving all sorts of complications for Nick's colleagues.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that that the margins on pig production are relatively tight already, Stuart?
Well, they've been worse than tight for the last 2 years or so. Pig farmers have been losing quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
And we've got a pig price now. I mean, I've been involved in pig production for a long, long time, and I would never have imagined a pig price where it is today, and for producers still not be making money.
It's tragic, isn't it? Now, Nick, I mean, frankly, this sounds terrifying to me. How worried is the UK meat industry about African swine fever? What's the buzz? What are people saying?
Well, you know, really worried. As Stuart said, lose the export market, lose the ability to export sort of sales and that whole sort of trade. And it devastates the whole industry. And, you know, our industry's been through enough over the last 2 years. It's on the floor as it is. So if something happened now, this is a serious concern to everyone. And we all pretty frustrated, really, that the lack of effort that's being sort of made by sort of government to really sort of control what's coming into the country. They have upped their games recently and started sort of stopping sort of vans coming here. But we knew there were vans coming in from the Eastern European sort of countries with pork that shouldn't be arriving in this sort of country and being sort of traded through very unknown sort of sources, really, you know. So that was a particularly sort of vulnerable from that point of view that it's coming into the country. And I've been very frustrated with the sort of government about the lack of border controls that we've got in sort of place for something that could be so devastating for our industry.
I thought Brexit was supposed to solve all that, but we'll come to that in a minute. So the question really is, Stuart, what measures are being put in place by the government and the meat industry to prevent an outbreak in the UK? Nick mentioned that it's been frustrating that there hasn't been more action by the government. What's your view?
I was frustrated because we know that government isn't very good at working quickly on things, but last September, they did make it illegal to bring in over 2 kilograms of pork or pork products, but As Nick mentioned earlier, it's these illegal white van loads that are the real risk, because they become distributed without any way of tracking them.
Can you tell us a little bit more about these white van loads that you talk about? I'm not really aware of this. So can you expand on what the nature of the problem is?
We were aware for some time that actually, and had been observed anecdotally, that sort of white vans were arriving with, you know, half carcasses, whole carcasses of pig meat from Eastern sort of Europe. You know, the government did actually, as Stuart said, they did step in and start to sort of make it illegal, and they started to, you know, put some action in place and started stopping some of these vans. And sure enough, they found freezers and unchilled meat coming here. They've been carted right across sort of Europe in the backs of these vans, and nearly seized the contents and obviously sort of prosecuted. But it's quite a limited team they've got in place sort of doing this. So it's
funny,
they happily assume, well, oh, we've just caught a little bit. And I heard the minister describe it recently. So, well, yeah, we have managed to catch those, but it's not a lot. But they don't know, you know.
How would you know when you haven't caught?
We don't know, you know. So our fear is that there's a lot more coming in than we suspect, really. But it shouldn't have been on the sort of the market anyway. And secondly, to be coming from those countries really is a high risk for us.
Yeah.
And we could really do the government sort of taking this a lot more seriously and also upping the public awareness of this as well, really. But it's
when they brought the powers in to seize meat at the ports and borders, it's a positive step. And I think that the implementation has been quite long, though, and they've promised a review of the progress. And that is absolutely integral to us being able to take this policy further forward. So, yeah, they're able to now make seizures, but we want to see where the gaps are in that. Where are they struggling? Where does there need to be more resource? And that will give us the asks that we will have to be able to deliver better on this policy. And I think that's absolutely vital for us to progress.
Yeah.
And I know government are doing some communications work that's really targeted as well, but it's a whole plethora of actions that we need. It's not just one thing.
There are extra pluses for government in this, because these white van folks are naughty boys and girls. And whilst they're picking up illegal pig meat imports, they're also picking up other illegal commodities and breaking into rings of gangs that are polluting our home market.
Yeah. Okay, now, my question really is, are there other solutions on the table? I believe that there's the first experimental vaccine has been licensed in Vietnam, but it's not yet widely available. Are there other longer-term solutions? Do we need greater breed diversity? Does it affect all pigs, or are there any other breeds that are less susceptible, Stuart?
So, yes, it affects all pigs within within that genetic category. Rebecca would answer that better than me.
So the vaccine development over in Vietnam has been really positive. There's actually two vaccines now that are progressing. One was due to be rolled out a couple of months ago. What's important, though, is that the use of vaccination has to be legally permitted. So yeah. Under our rules in this country, you couldn't just jump into utilising a vaccine. You have to be able to differentiate between a vaccinated animal and an unvaccinated animal in order to be able to identify the disease. And in parts of the world where there is, like, it's at an endemic level, it's absolutely part of the toolbox they need to be able to firstly contain and then control and then eradicate the disease. But for us in this country, it's probably not an avenue we'd go down simply because it's really important for us to be able to trade. And we need to demonstrate our disease freedom should we be asked to. And you can't necessarily do that when you use a vaccine because vaccines are very, very detailed. I'm not going to go into the intricacies of the technology, but ultimately we need to be able to continue to trade. And we couldn't do that if we were to roll out a vaccine.
That's if I can just say that's a really important point Rebecca's just made, actually, because, you know, yes, vaccines are a sort of double-edged sword, really. Yes, it cures the immediate problem, but, you know, you then actually depends on the country you wanted to export to and, you know, depending on their ASF status, you know, so with any vaccination, it's, you know, you have to consider it very carefully. And so it's a really important point that to understand.
Gotcha. Now, Stuart, one thing that struck me when I was researching this is there going to be a secondary impact on the meat consumption debate? You know, the perception that animal husbandry is prone to problems like this and avian flu and that livestock inevitably suffer because of mass farming of non-diverse groups of animals. Are you concerned that it will feed into the anti-livestock debate?
Well, I mean, it's obviously certainly not going to help. But government and the representative bodies go to great lengths to explain that these diseases are specific to whichever animal is affected by it, and that onward transmission, even through infected meat to humans, is a very, very low risk. It's something else that we've got to deal with, but I don't see it having a long-term big impact.
I would just say HDB has a consumer insights team and they do a lot of work looking at consumer confidence within a variety of products, including pork. And what I would say is there is confidence in pork producers as people in terms of providing safe, traceable and tasty pork. So the confidence there in pork is really good. We've seen people during the cost of living crisis trade into pork. Now, that's a difficult thing to map out, but the signs are good and people remain confident in the pork purchases that they make.
Gotcha. So, Nick, you mentioned the government's lack of tools for intervention. What impact is Brexit having on preventing the disease coming here? I mean, surely that was sort of the idea behind Brexit. And then does that throw things like the Northern Ireland Protocol and the various system put in place there into doubt?
Yeah, without wanting to get too political, you know, we're still waiting to see any much in the way, and certainly in our industry, of benefits on some Brexit. And you would think actually this might be one of them, a bit more sort of tighter control of our borders.
Were pork producers quite keen on Brexit as a general sort of view, do you think?
I'd let the farmers answer that. answer that. You know, I think
if... So as an apolitical organisation.
Yeah. But you've all got your own personal views as well.
As an apolitical organisation, we can't comment on that.
Look, Brexit's happened. We've got to make the best of it. And you'd actually think one of the benefits might be of Brexit, that actually we could actually control our borders a lot more. The reality is the government has put no controls in on what's been coming in here from Europe. Actually, you know, it's just been an open door. In fact, actually, I think there's less controls than there were pre-Brexit. Yeah. That's a frustration sort of to us all, really, because, you know, certainly if we're exporting to Europe, we've got a sort of cost of exporting to Europe and have to do through lots of hurdles. Whereas to bring something into this country, there's hardly any hurdles at all. And even going forward, it rather looks as though when they do start to implement some of these controls, looking at what they're planning to do and something called the target operating sort of model, it looks as though they're going to make it actually easier for stuff to come in here from Europe. So, you know, whether you'd have thought on the face of it there would be a sort of a disease control sort of benefit of Brexit, I don't see any whatsoever at all, and we certainly haven't seen it so far.
Gosh, it's almost like the promises of Brexit was a lie.
Just to quantify, I recently visited the port of Dover, and a ship comes in every 30 minutes. So you can imagine the volume of traffic that travels through just that one port. The restrictions are very difficult to deliver on just because of the sheer volume. And that's not just passenger traffic, that's all the freight and the, you know, roll on roll off stuff that they do as well. There's a lot of product and people that travel through each of our ports every single day.
But on the flip side, the economic damage from something like this happening would far outweigh the investment in better resources. So, Rebecca, let's posit that an outbreak happening. What would the likely chain of events be that would unfold to prevent the further spread?
So the government has a very clear contingency plan and actions that they follow. That's underpinned by the legal framework and sort of what's legally required to happen. So immediately around the infected premise, they put a protection zone and a surveillance zone in place. And that's up to 10 kilometres, although the Secretary of State and CVO can make that larger if they wish to. There are likely to be other restriction zones that will be put in place when that comes into force later this year. So their plan is, like I said, was to contain, control, and then eradicate the disease. And so they would cull out the infected herd. They then carry out a preliminary cleansing process in order to eradicate any, you know, virus that's there on farm. And I think that, you know, as it pans out, there are, you know, obviously there are movement restrictions. Pigs within zones are not permitted to move without licence. They don't issue licence within the first few days, and it's all done on a case-by-case risk-based approach. So it has massive disruptive effects. As Nick said, we'd lose our ability to trade, most likely overnight, and we are totally reliant on that for our carcass balance. So it has, huge implications. The kind of activity that follows after that is dependent on how widespread it is, but the government acts on a risk-based way in order to minimise that impact. And as you saw in 2001, lots of people listening to your podcast may remember that widespread foot and mouth outbreak. And the rules have been tightened and tightened over the years to try and plan and hope that we wouldn't end up with such a widespread disease outbreak again. But it's incredibly challenging.
Yeah. And is there anything to be learnt from other countries' dealings with outbreaks? So have there been mistakes made or new solutions that have been that we can learn from?
Yes, absolutely. So we follow quite closely what other countries are doing. And I think in the countries like Romania and Poland, where they've had real issues, there's a lot to learn what not to do, really. And there's a challenge there in terms of some of the infrastructure to support what they need to happen. But a lot of it comes down to biosecurity and the fact that they have the wildlife vector in wild boar. And we do have wild boar in this country. Our herd is much smaller. Mm-hmm. And it's also not near where our pig dense regions are. So we do have a lot to learn from them. In Germany, they've taken a very robust approach and they've still struggled with trying to contain it. So it just goes to prove this virus is pretty hardy and does give everyone the runaround, but definitely lots to learn in terms of biosecurity from Germany.
Stephen, it's worth mentioning that, you know, before those questions that you asked, Rebecca, I would say I'm generally quite happy with the regulation and controls of movement of meat and meat products, both here and in Europe, because we've been involved in making the European laws in previous years. And that's all fine as far as mainstream production is concerned. We're back to the point that Nick made earlier. It's the uncontrolled meat that is the risk.
Yeah.
However, if infected product does come into this country, we don't get the disease infecting our herd as long as we've got a separation between that meat coming in and access to our pig herd. And all of the organisations that represent, and DEFRA, that represent the pig sector, have put out an awful lot of publicity on biosecurity. And in fact, the standards are included in the Red Tractor standards in order to help prevent an incursion onto a farm.
And Nick, this is a slightly controversial way to go about it, but is there likely to be any malicious intent in this? Would there be any parties who would be interested in the UK suffering from African swine fever?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I suppose you could always sort of look for conspiracy sort of theories. I'd like to think not that someone would do that. If you're interested in animal welfare, you certainly wouldn't want to introduce this disease into the country. Mm. But I think the critical thing that we need to sort of look at here is actually sort of public awareness. As Rebecca alluded to earlier, you can still, anyone coming into this country is still bringing sort of 2 kilos of meat in. And that is our danger. And that's how the Belgians got it. If we're looking at, you know, what do we learn from what's happened on the continent? That's how the sort of Belgians sort of got it. We sort of think it moved by humans. So it's the 2 kilos of meat coming in. Someone's brought some in a sandwich. You know, they stop in
it's a
lake
big sandwich.
They throw it at, they throw it over the fence. You know, a fox picks it up and cuts it into a pig field. You know, it's as easy as that. And it's lack of public awareness. I think whilst it's harsh, we'd almost like to see that sort of 2 kilos stopped completely, really, sort of coming into the country. Because I think that is the biggest threat we have got in getting hit here. I have absolute confidence that if we get something in this country, we've got really good controls. We've got plans in place and we've got authorities that will actually sort of do a really good job of containing it. But the damage is done by then. We've got to keep it out, you know, and that's really important. And I think actually, you know, sort of trying to sort of get that message through to sort of the public and make them more aware of just, you know, how serious just a casual thing could be done. It's just, you know, leaving a sandwich in a lay-by, you know, sort of could be that dangerous, really.
I have to say, it seems extraordinary to me that with something as virulent as African swine fever around, that you can bring 2 kilos of meat into the country. I'm slightly baffled that still exists. So the question really, to wrap this up, and this is a question for all of you, is what action would you like to see being taken at any level, government, international, industry level, to prevent the spread of this disease? But Nick, perhaps you can kick off for us.
Well, I'll sort of kick off with that. I'd like to see, you know, they've made the move to sort of making it illegal to bring pork in here. I'd like them to sort of move and get rid of that sort of 2 kilo sort of rule as well, really, because that would actually heighten public's awareness. If you suddenly say your signs up saying you cannot bring any sort of meat into this country, that would heighten the sort of public awareness. I'd like them to see them up their game on checking these white vans going in, because I don't think we've really got on top of those, you know, so that's more checks from that point of view, you know. So, but let's say more public awareness and actually getting rid of that 2 kilos of limit. As I say, I think the two go hand in hand, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Stuart, what would you like to see being done?
Well, I echo Nick's comments and just say that disease control's got to continue to be a joint effort between all of our good selves and our DEFRA colleagues.
Very good. And Rebecca, if you can just finish off for us, do you think there are other things that can be done? What action would you like to see being taken? What do you think about the 2 kilo limit?
Yes, I totally agree. We need to have a review of the measures that were brought in last September in order to pinpoint exactly how we make those reductions. I agree with Nick, that needs to come right down. I want to see that, you know, we go back to the ham sandwich analogy. In addition, we need continued communications. DEFRA has started some targeted communications campaigns. They're at pilot phase. We want to see that rolled out more widely. And that is focusing on people travelling into this country from areas of the EU that are most affected by ASF. We also need to push that out into wider audiences. For instance, things like students, so people like students and seasonal labour workers coming into this country. You know, it goes much broader than that.
Well, what I've learned here is that there seems to be a coherent and direct and very sensible set of ideas that you would like to see implemented. So I was going to say I cross my fingers and hope everything's going to go well, but that's frankly just not enough, is it? I hope that change happens and that we manage this as best we can. Nick Allen, Stuart Houston and Rebecca Veal, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.